Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 16-year-old Big Spring basketball player J.T. Kuhn and 13-year-old Darren Godby, a student at the Milton Hershey School, both died earlier this month of sudden cardiac arrest. Not heart attacks, but sudden cardiac arrest. Former Penn State and Redland High School basketball player Jermaine Marshall also suffered from a heart condition and passed away last January. Three young people who were active and, by all appearances, in good physical condition. So how could they be killed by a heart defect? And should young athletes, their parents, and coaches, what should they be thinking about this threat? Joining us today is Julie Walker, Executive Director of the Peyton Walker Foundation. Julie Walker, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us is Dr. Michael Bosak, who is Interventional Cardiologist and UPMC Pinnacle's Director of Cardiovascular Quality Assurance. Mike Bosak, you have a longer title than the last time I saw you.
It keeps growing. Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. The deaths of these young men and boys shocked a lot of people. And people asking themselves, how can athletes, young people in good physical condition, how could they be killed by a heart defect? Julie?
Well, this is a headline that we knew was going to hit one day. We lost our daughter, Peyton, unexpectedly to cardiac arrest back in 2013. And since then, we've been on a mission to really educate the community, to raise awareness of sudden cardiac arrest. And I kept saying, you know, people just aren't paying attention. And until we have a tragic headline here in the mid-state, no one is going to pay attention to this. Because you look at these kids, they look healthy, they seem healthy. A lot of them are high-performing athletes, and they have no idea they're walking around with an undiagnosed heart condition. So sudden cardiac arrest, I mean, the statistics are there. It's the number one killer of student athletes in our country. It is the leading cause of death on school campuses. And every hour, every day, we lose a kid to sudden cardiac arrest. And like you had said, it's not a heart attack. And that's what the initial headlines were that came out about it, particularly these two young men who just recently passed.
And Dr. Bosak, let's talk a little bit about the differences between sudden cardiac arrest and heart attacks, because just yesterday, as I was preparing for the program, I looked back at the headlines, and in both cases, now Jermaine Marshall was a little bit different because he was playing basketball in France, and it was a few days before we actually knew what the cause of death was, but it was reported as heart attacks. So why does everyone think it was a heart attack right off the bat?
Because heart attack is simple. Something happened to the heart, therefore we're going to call it a heart attack. But the difference between what we all think of as a heart attack and sudden cardiac arrest is the difference between plumbing and electricity. From a heart attack standpoint, you have a blockage in your plumbing. You have either a total 100% blockage in one of the heart arteries that shuts down blood flow to the heart muscle. That's usually what gives the chest pain. And then from there, you go on to have other sequelae of a heart attack, meaning they get short of breath, and they can have heart arrhythmia issues then. Sudden cardiac arrest is usually a heart rhythm or an electrical issue, and this can happen for any one of a number of reasons, such as a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy that we'll talk more about later. It can happen due to coronary arteries being made wrong when an infant was born. It can be due to electrical abnormalities due to electrolytes and things along those lines. But the sudden cardiac arrest that we talk about in young student athletes is usually an electrical arrhythm problem, and that's the difference.
Am I correct in describing this as a heart defect?
Maybe. In some cases, it may be. We have instances of student athletes who die who then went on to unfortunately have an autopsy and find that their heart was just never right. You know, it was built wrong right out of the start. And then you have other ones that are just minor anomalies that just happen hit at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm. Julie, you said that you knew this day was coming and it would take something like this, the news of these three young men passing away due to sudden cardiac arrest. Why isn't the public aware of this? I mean, that's what your mission is with the Peyton Walker Foundation, is to make people aware, but why aren't they aware?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it harkens back to people, like, they just don't expect kids to drop over dead from a heart problem. And kids during their routine physicals and sports physicals, they're not getting a true deep dive check of their heart. Typically, when they have their screenings and their physicals, they're only getting their hearts checked by a stethoscope. And a stethoscope cannot detect hidden electrical issues within the heart. So it's going to miss about 90 to 95% of electrical problems. So, you know, our kids are getting the same physicals now that we got 40, 50 years ago, in spite of all of the advances in medicine. We're giving them the same physical. So I say that, wow, we are really failing our kids in this regard. And I think it's time we really challenge the medical community to embrace routine baseline EKG screenings as part of the standard of care and get that incorporated for the kids.
Why wouldn't they do that?
That's a great question. The easy answer would just be cost, but that's not the right answer. The right answer is because if your son or daughter has an EKG in their pediatrician's office now, there are certain things that are abnormal for adults but normal for kids and vice versa in looking at EKGs. And then there's a transition where people go from what's called a pediatric EKG to an adult EKG. And sometimes in that transition, things can look pathologic, bad, when they aren't necessarily bad. And so if you have a son or daughter who has that EKG and all of a sudden you have red flags raised by your pediatrician and they say, well, we'll get you in to see a cardiologist, that'll be 3 months from now. You have 3 months of, you know, of terror and, you know, what's going to happen next? Should I let my son out of my sight? If you have just routine screening and things are good, that's great. But routine screening without the appropriate follow-up or timely follow-up, which is one of the big issues, that's where things start to put more fear in there than what we're going to actually find problems. And so the fear of the unknown definitely plays a role. In screening such as what Julie has set up with the Peyton Walker Foundation, where we do the EKG, we do the physical exam, and we do follow-up echocardiograms and close follow-up with pediatric cardiologists all at the same time, is really the ideal way to do it because you don't have that time lag in between where you have the fear of the unknown. If somebody flags an EKG or a cardiac exam as being abnormal, we immediately go on to the heart ultrasound, the echocardiogram next. We look at the heart sort of from the inside out, more or less, make sure it's structurally right, and then we actually sit down and have them see one of our pediatric cardiologists. So it's one-stop shopping. All within about 2 to 3 hours, we can have everything done. Is this an issue, and do we need to be followed closely for the rest of this young adult's life? Or is this something that's just, yeah, you're transitioning from a pediatric look in your EKG to an adult EKG, and this is normal?
Julie, one of the things that probably adds a level of surprise to this is that the cases we've heard about often are young athletes. And by all appearances, and you know, I don't know why anyone would doubt it, other than if they've had some kind of thorough examination, they appear to be in great physical health and that, you know, they're at the top of their games. So, again, that brings a level of surprise. Are we talking just about athletes? Does that level of activity add to this? Does it exacerbate? I'll say the word right. Yeah.
Let us help you.
Yeah.
Exacerbate.
Does it make it worse?
Well, I will here to say that this strikes athletes and non-athletes. It does not discriminate. I think there's a misnomer that it is only athletes that suffer from sudden cardiac arrest. My daughter was not an athlete. She was not participating in sports when she had her cardiac arrest. I think we tie it to athletes because those are the headlines. We see the kids dropping over dead on the basketball court or collapsing on the football field. So that's what makes the sensational headlines and grabs the attention. These are kids who are high profile. All eyes are on them. You know, there a lot of times at these sporting events, there's cameras and so everything's being videotaped, so you can actually see the cardiac arrest happen. But there's so many kids that go to bed at night and never wake up in the morning because they have a cardiac arrest while they're sleeping. My daughter didn't make the headlines, the sensational headlines. And again, she was not an athlete. So to parents who have kids that aren't athletes, doesn't mean your kids are out of the woods. There could be a potential heart issue lurking. And we say 2 to 3% of kids are walking around with an undiagnosed heart condition that may potentially lead to cardiac arrest.
To follow up on what Julie says, the athletes do put their heart under load obviously. It's sort of like I could go out to your car, pop the hood, take a look at the engine and go, oh, that looks good. But it's not until you step on the gas, you know what it's really going to do. And so there are certain times that, yes, sudden cardiac arrest for certain arrhythmic issues, such as what's called a long QT syndrome, can happen in their sleep or when somebody's doing not much. But there are definitely issues related to the heart being put under physical demand. And that's one of the reasons that we do focus not specifically on athletes, but we definitely want to screen athletes. Mm. Because there is no doubt if you've been running on a basketball court for the last 40 minutes or doing summer training for a football team, your heart is definitely being asked more of it than what it would be if you're sitting there, at home having dinner. It can happen anytime, though.
When almost all of us of any age, when we go to our doctor's office for a physical or for whatever reason, and they're asking about your health history, your medical history, especially if they're looking at heart, one of the questions is about family history mm-hmm. with heart disease. Are there, and that's a risk factor
yes.
with heart disease, are there risk factors with sudden cardiac arrest?
There definitely are. And again, sudden cardiac arrest is a spectrum. There are certain things that just happen totally as a one-off bad set of circumstances. It just was all wrong. And then there's other ones that are genetic predispositions. To delve a little deeper into Julie's family, Julie's dad had to undergo a heart transplant. And Julie and I have been very good friends for many years because we met first as a doctor and a patient, okay? And so there are definitely things that run in certain families. And if you have a family member who had a cardiac issue at less than 50, you probably should be screened younger. And depending upon what that cardiac issue was should have your kid screened as well.
Mm-hmm. Julie, tell me about that. You said that Peyton was an athlete, but she was. I mean, in high school, because I've seen pictures of her, she ran track, right?
She didn't really run track. She was more of the field participant, sports. But she played basketball through eighth grade. We have a little different angle than a lot of families because Peyton was diagnosed with a heart condition.
That was my next question.
Right. Okay. So I was diagnosed in my late 20s, and once they found hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in me because it is genetic, then they started checking my kids. So we followed the kids for a number of years. Peyton was finally found to have it when she was in fifth grade. So by the end of eighth grade, we knew that it was time to pull her from active sports. She could no longer play basketball, couldn't play volleyball. So we made a little bit of an adjustment in the activities that she participated in. So we knew what we were dealing with. I think part of the thing, too, that parents really need to pay attention to, talk about signs and symptoms with your kids, because a lot of times kids are having signs or symptoms of a potential underlying heart condition. And number one, they either ignore them because they don't want to get pulled from sports and not be allowed to play. Or number two, they don't even recognize or identify it as a potential sign or symptom because it's something they've always experienced and they don't even realize it's abnormal. We talk about shortness of breath, chest pain or pressure, lightheadedness, palpitations, passing out,
yeah,
obviously.
The big one is passing out. If somebody passes out in an athletic event, that person should be screened until, it's sorted out. That
Absolutely.
Is a big red flag.
So it's so important to have that discussion with your kids, athletes or non-athletes. Are they experiencing any of those symptoms? Because it could be a sign that something is going on that should be checked out.
You say that Peyton was aware and that you limited her activities. I mean, did she rebel against that, fight back against it, or
no.
Was it just something
She's
that
a teenager, of course.
I know.
Well, she did. And, because I, too, live with this heart condition, and I live a very full, active life. I don't let my heart condition define me and limit me. And I kind of led that with Peyton. I instilled that in her. You will not be defined or limited by your heart condition. There are a few things that you cannot do. You cannot play basketball. You cannot play volleyball. But there are 100,000 things you can do. And I anytime she would complain about it, I would shut it down. I'm like, no, we're not going to live that woe is me life.
And one of the
You're
things
a nasty
I do,
mom, you know that.
I know. Well, it's okay.
Yeah, that's probably what she said. Now
yes.
You are a loving mom,
yes,
but
yeah.
Caring about your daughter. But that's probably what she was thinking
Absolutely.
At the time.
Well,
yeah.
She's a teenager.
I know.
And what Julie picks up on is every parent's concern, which is, what if we do find something? at one of these screenings. It depends on what we find. We find some very minor, you know, heart issues that it's like, yeah, that probably would have been picked up later in life. We got it earlier. We'll just watch you closely. And then there's other things we've picked up. We've picked up people with cardiac tumors. We picked up people with heart rhythm issues that they were playing sports and they were having symptoms, but they weren't telling anybody because they wanted to keep playing. And we picked up a heart rhythm issue that then went on to have what's called an ablation and a fix, and that student athlete is back playing sports safely without symptoms. But just because somebody is screened and if we find something doesn't mean it's a catastrophic, you got to stop what you're doing. More often than not, it's we're going to keep a close eye on you. The other flip, the other side of that coin is that a one-time screening does not mean you're all clear. Okay, and that's one of the big things that we put out there with the Peyton Walker Foundation is that it's a continuum. If you're, you know, having your son or daughter screened at 12, 13 years old and they're good, that doesn't mean that their pediatrician or their family doc or in the future their internist can ignore their heart because they were screened once when they were 12. If something changes, symptoms develop or other things happen, they need to be looked at again. A one-time screening is very good. If we find something, we know we can watch it. If we have a negative result, nothing is found, that's great. It's peace of mind, but it doesn't mean you turn a blind eye to anything that happens in the future.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I'd like to remind you to check out some upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. Tomorrow is something that we've been planning for some time now, and it's because there is a date affixed to it. But tomorrow is the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident. So on Smart Talk, we will be talking about TMI tomorrow. A poll that Franklin Marshall College did, their quarterly poll will be out tomorrow, and there are several questions about the future of nuclear power. That we'll be speaking with Burwood Yost of FNM about that. And just a couple of things there. Also, I want to remind you that coming up tomorrow night on WITF-TV, we have two documentaries, one that looks back at the history of the Three Mile Island accident and another that looks ahead to the future of nuclear power here in Pennsylvania and really across the country. You can see some of the shows we're working at on WITF.org. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. Find out what's coming up at WITF.org/Smart Talk. This portion of the program today, we're talking with Julie Walker, Executive Director of the Peyton Walker Foundation, Dr. Michael Bosak, who is Interventional Cardiologist and UPMC Pinnacle's Director of Cardiovascular Quality Assurance, talking about sudden cardiac arrest. And you probably have heard about the three young men who recently perished here in central Pennsylvania or from central Pennsylvania of sudden cardiac arrest and what you can do, how you can get screened. Things you should look for. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @smarttalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Julie Walker, as part of the Peyton Walker Foundation, one of the things that the organization does is set up screenings so that young people can come and get more than that just low-level perfunctionary physical that we've gotten over the years. There's one scheduled for April 6th. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we reached out to Redland High School as soon as we read the headline about Jermaine Marshall, the alum from Redland who went on to play basketball at Penn State and then was playing semi-pro ball over in Europe and had died due to sudden cardiac arrest unexpectedly in January. So we reached out to Redland, asked if they would like to host a screening on his behalf and in his memory, and immediately they said, yes, let's do it. So we set up the screening with our partners at UPMC Pinnacle, and Redland announced the screening, and within 20 hours, it was completely filled, and we now have 120, 125 kids on the wait list. So, and I think that's because of the recent headlines. I mean, parents are finally paying attention. They realize that, you know, the sports physicals aren't enough. We really need to do a deeper dive in to look at these kids' hearts. So registering for the screening, there is no cost to register. There's no copay. We do not collect insurance information. It is absolutely 100% free. The foundation works hard throughout the year to raise funds to make these services available at no cost to the public. So what we're doing right now, we actually have other screenings posted on our website, peytonwalker.org. You can jump out there and take a look at what where our other screenings are going to be in the future. But when kids come in, they have to be pre-registered. As Dr. Bosak had mentioned, you know, we'll check their vitals. We listen for heart murmurs. We do an electrocardiogram. And if anything comes back abnormal or maybe they have some unusual family history, we will also provide an echocardiogram on the spot. So as he indicated, I mean, you'll get the full spectrum of an exam that day, and you will walk out with information whether or not your heart is okay today.
So, you know, I'm curious, and you can't probably get into too technical, and there probably are a lot of answers to this question. But when Julie, and when you say, Dr. Posack, abnormal, what are you looking for?
Well, the first thing that you're taught in medical school is that you get 70% of your diagnosis or so from the history. Okay, so the first thing that happens with the Peyton Walker Foundation registration is you have to go online and you have to answer a series of questions related to your student's health, any meds they're on, any symptoms they've had, but also your family history as well. And so as when I'm examining these patients as part of the Peyton Walker Foundation, I can go back and look and see how their questions were answered. Were there literally any red flags? We have a red flag symbol on, or, you know, do they have racing heartbeats? Have they passed out? Have they had a family member with sudden cardiac arrest? Those types of red flags, automatically those students get pulled and we'll do a much closer workup, you know, such as an echocardiogram and a visit with one of the pediatric cardiologists, just if you have significant red flags in your history. Then on physical exam, there's certain things that are benign murmurs. We have, you know, tall, thin kids. We have short kids that aren't so thin. We have everything in between. And so there's certain things that you just know, you listen to, and that's benign. It's okay. It's what a kid's heart is supposed to sound like. And then there's other times you put a stethoscope on a chest and you stop and you say, there's just something not right here. And a stethoscope is great, but a heart ultrasound is better. And so we talk to the student, we talk to the parents, and we say, we hear something that's just slightly abnormal. There's something about your EKG. There's something about your history. We want to take a deeper look into this. And when I first started with this with Julie, you hesitated telling that parent that, because I'm a parent, and what if somebody came to me? But the look of relief on parents' faces, which is, thank God this was found. Thank God there's somebody here who can take a look at this. Thank God I don't have to wait 3 months until I can get a heart ultrasound done. They then sit and they talk. There have been tears. There have been times where people are like, oh, crap, what happens if we find something? But, you know, more often than not, 9 times out of 10, it turns out to be a benign issue, something we can just watch. And then there's other times where we do have to sit down and have that conversation with, you know, when you walked in here, we thought everything was good. Walking out of here, we have to, you know, see you much more closely. We've referred some people down to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We've referred some people down to the Pediatric Hospital of Penn State. Julie works hand in hand with both of those organizations. But yeah, there are times that, you know, we walk out of there going, you know, this was a good thing. Today we helped somebody.
We have an email here from Tom. It says, for sudden cardiac arrest, it is absolutely essential to have CPR-trained trainers and an AED close by. I'm an EMS. It takes time to process a 911 call, dispatch us, and for EMS to get to the scene. Immediate intervention with an AED and CPR will give the child the best chance of survival.
Amen. So one of the things I'm so incredibly proud of, too, at every heart screening that we host, we get every kid on the floor, teach them CPR, teach them how to use an AED, and oftentimes the families will get involved as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not just the student that's there to be screened. It's their younger sister, their younger brother, their parents. Everybody, when they see CPR training going on, everybody gets involved.
AED, just so everyone knows.
Automated external defibrillator. So you'll see them hanging on the walls in airports, schools, buildings. But there's not enough out there. And that's another huge component of one of the programs that we provide. The foundation donates AEDs. We've put about 85 all throughout the mid-state so far. So again, you can jump out to PeytonWalker.org for information on how to apply for an AED donation.
And to give you an idea, those 85 AEDs cost between $3,000 and $5,000 each. And that's all money that Julie has raised through her foundation.
CPR training is one thing. Knowing when to use an AED, though, seems like to be a totally different.
No, it's all part of the
really?
Regular CPR training now.
Okay.
I mean, truthfully, if you're getting trained for CPR, you're being taught that you call 911. You know, you're taught how to do CPR, and you're taught how to use an automatic external defibrillator, because they are, you know, you don't want to say foolproof, but darn near foolproof. Yes.
Are teachers, are coaches trained to know how to do this?
Not enough. I actually just spoke to about 1,000 educators yesterday with the Pennsylvania Department of Education, and so many of them, number one, they have maybe done CPR a couple years ago, don't quite remember. And then we asked the question, well, is there an AED at your school? I'm not sure exactly where it is. And that's alarming to me, because if we're putting AEDs out there, And number one, people don't know how to use them or where they're located or if they're accessible. That's definitely a concern. And we challenge the schools to really take a look at that and make sure your AEDs are available. And kids know how to do CPR and the teachers know how to do CPR.
Well, yeah, you would say, okay, fire extinguisher may be a good comparison. Mm-hmm. I mean, would someone who works in a school not know where a fire extinguisher is or how to use it? Kind of the same thing.
It is. And how many fires do we really have in schools versus how many cardiac arrests do we have in schools?
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, why is our focus on fire safety and not CPR safety?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all important, but yes, your analogy is spot on. I think that if you know how to squeeze the trigger and point it at the base of a fire to put out a fire, you should know how to pull out the AED and put it on somebody.
Mm-hmm. We have another listener email here has several questions. Do pediatric AKGs reduce the number of children, teenagers who die from sudden cardiac arrest?
Maybe. Just the EKG alone doesn't fix anything. It's the interpretation of the EKG. And this is where our training of our pediatricians and our family docs has changed over the last 5 to 10 years. Initially, they didn't do EKGs. They just referred somebody out. Now, a lot of offices can do EKGs on younger kids than what they've done before. It was always easier not to do it. It's rarely reimbursed by their insurance. And if it's normal, it's normal. If it's not, then that person has to figure out who to send it to and how to get them there. But as I speak to our younger family practice residents in the program and also pediatricians, they are learning this now when they did not before.
So a follow-up question to that, what role do routine well child visits have in preventing and diagnosing pediatric heart conditions, often children and teenagers, forgo well child visits with a doctor who knows them and have their pre-participation physical and an urgent care by a physician or advanced practice provider who does not know the patient, has no connection to the patient? Can you comment on the importance of children and teenagers continuing annual well visits with a primary care physician or pediatrician?
Yeah, well visits are great. They need to be done. You know, we can dig into vaccines some other day. They need to be done. The exam that needs to be done prior to physical activities and sports are slightly different. There's certain what are called cardiac maneuvers where you listen to a heart when somebody is squatting and then when they're standing. You have them take deep breaths. You have them turn on their side. There's certain things you should be listening to. Unfortunately, most of these screening physicals that, you know, my son has been involved in and my daughter when she played sports are very basic. Height, weight, blood pressure. Do they have two eyes? How many fingers do they have?
Do they have two eyes?
Do they have a hernia? Turn your head and cough and
there you go. That's right. What everybody, yes. Every boy that yes. I've ever, you yes. know, whenever I played just sports 40 years ago, that was what everyone focused on.
And
was
that's the same physical the kids are getting now.
And unfortunately, I mean, again, I don't mean to sound flippant, but I've never seen anybody, you know, get carted off in an ambulance because they have a hernia.
Right.
You know, there are other things that are far more important. Mm-hmm. We treat concussions much better now than we did 10 to 15 years ago. The next level is treating the potential sudden cardiac arrest.
One risk factor I didn't hear during our discussion is age. You know, we focused on Jermaine Marsh was 28, but the other two were teenagers. Mm-hmm. Is this something that is age related? I mean, is age a factor? Because, for example, with heart disease, with heart attacks, as someone has a bad diet, doesn't have physical activity as they age, it is a factor. What about here?
I mean, not necessarily. We start our screening around age 12. It doesn't mean that something can't happen sooner, but usually it's somewhere in puberty, the hormones start to hit, and people become more physically active. But there is not a definite, hey, age 17 is the age you need to look at. It is really just part of the process. It's something that we just need to be involved in from, you know, that time that student starts having well kid visits right up until I see them when they're older.
What about when they're older, though? I mean, is there a cutoff line for sudden cardiac arrest?
Sudden cardiac arrest can happen at any age. There are people that have heart rhythm issues or other heart issues that were never found that unfortunately now they're in their 50s and something happens. And again, it gets labeled as a heart attack. And unfortunately, if you're in your 50s and you drop over and can't be resuscitated, you're called a heart attack. And unless you have an autopsy that shows you had a blockage in one of the heart arteries, you could have had a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. You could have had a heart rhythm issue. Unfortunately, you know, the saying is dead. And at that point, a lot of families just want to move on. But if you have somebody who drops out of the blue, as tough as that conversation is, that person probably should have at least a limited autopsy to see if they did have something structurally wrong with their heart that could be an indication for other members in the family they need to be looked at.
We're almost out of time. A lot to talk about and a lot to think about. So, Julie, recommendations. How would you like to leave this with our audience?
Wow, I wish we had two more hours. Jump out to the website. Review the signs and symptoms. Have those conversations with your kids. Attend heart screenings if there's something available in your area. If not, have the conversation with your child's pediatrician or PCP. Ask, can you give my child a baseline EKG? Education is power in this circumstance, and parents really need to pay attention. Hmm.
Julie Walker, the Peyton Walker Foundation, Dr. Michael Bosak of UPMC Pinnacle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen, tomorrow for Smart Talk, it is the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island. We'll be discussing what actually happened at TMI on March 28, 1979, talking about the future of nuclear power. Just a whole lot going on tomorrow morning on Smart Talk. Take some of your stories as well tomorrow morning. And again, I want to remind you of the TV documentaries we have on WITF-TV tomorrow night. The first one at 8 p.m., looking at what happened 40 years ago in 1979, and the second, looking ahead to nuclear power's future here in Pennsylvania and across the country. 50 years ago, there was a lot that happened 50 years ago, a lot of anniversaries this year. But 50 years ago, police in New York City raided a Greenwich Village neighborhood bar called the Stonewall Inn. The bar was frequented by members of the LGBTQ community, and in the days that followed, there was a succession of violent demonstrations challenging the police action. The Stonewall riots were widely considered the flashpoint to the gay rights movement. A traveling history exhibit highlighting Stonewall and the efforts of activists here in Pennsylvania is now showing throughout the state. The Long Road to LGBTQ plus Equality in Pennsylvania is sponsored by the Pennsylvania LGBT History Network. Joining us to tell us about the exhibit and a whole lot more is Barry Loveland. He's chair of the LGBT History Project. Barry Loveland, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Also joining us is Mary Nancaro, who is an LGBT community activist, and she helped to pass the Harrisburg Non-Discrimination Ordinance. Ms. Nancaro, welcome to the show as well.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. If you have a question or comment that you would like to leave on Facebook, go to WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk. WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'm not going to do a lot of focus on Stonewall, but that's kind of what sets this all up with the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. What happened at the Stonewall Inn and in Greenwich Village 50 years ago?
Well, Stonewall was an event that's really kind of a pivotal moment in the LGBTQ movement. It was really a flashpoint in energizing activists around the country to realize that it's time really to step up and to fight back and demand equal rights.
In what ways did it energize the LGBTQ community?
Well, really for the first time it was, a lot of people in the community, including a lot of trans women of color who were leading this fight to really bring attention to the fact that the LGBTQ community had really no protections whatsoever in terms of their employment, housing, public accommodations, and many other rights.
And we're going to talk about that because that's really what you're looking for here with this traveling exhibit, the non-discrimination here in Pennsylvania. But again, what happened at Stonewall was the police raided the bar, and that was commonplace.
Exactly.
And again, we use that as a flashpoint, but that was commonplace happening all over the country just because of the sexual orientation, gender identification of the people who were frequenting that bar, but other places across the country, right?
That's correct. And even in central Pennsylvania, we had our own incident of a bar being raided and closed. The first gay bar in Harrisburg, the Clock Bar, was raided and closed in 1965. So these are events that were pretty common at that time.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that history, because the exhibit itself talks about Pennsylvania history, and it's done in a number of ways. When I say number of ways, different media that is used.
Right.
But talk about some of that Pennsylvania history that comes into this.
Sure. Well, the exhibit really, we were looking for a way to kind of commemorate the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, because it's such a pivotal point in the movement, and it was we knew that it was going to receive a lot of attention this year because it is the 50th anniversary. So we were thinking about, how do we commemorate the Pennsylvania experience of trying to achieve LGBTQ rights? And so we began researching and putting together a script for an exhibit that talked about that there were actually more than 50 years of activism in Pennsylvania to achieve equal rights. And it started in Philadelphia with a couple of demonstrations in 1965, and then something called the Annual Reminders were done through a number of groups getting together and protesting in front of Independence Hall on July 4th. And those protests were kind of an annual reminder to people that we don't have equal rights. And so then the exhibit talks about those incidents, and it talks about really the whole long road, if you will, of trying to achieve equal protections in Pennsylvania, one municipality at a time and one battle at a time. And so we focus on a number of case studies of different cities and communities in Pennsylvania where activists have been successful in achieving local protections through local ordinances.
Mary, Harrisburg is one of those cities, and you were very involved in anti-discrimination efforts in Harrisburg. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. Well, first of all, it took 10 years for Philadelphia to gain some protections in their local human relations ordinance, and they finally passed their ordinance in 1982. We immediately began in 82 in conjunction with the Harrisburg Human Relations Commission Executive Director Michael Bowles at that time, and with City Council and a lot of allied groups to fashion an ordinance that would include what we now call sexual orientation and transgender protections to be free of discrimination. At that time, of course, we had a pervasive climate of fear. One could not be out in any way in public. You didn't talk about your partner or relationship. Everything was hidden. If you were to be outed or to disclose that you were gay or lesbian, you very well could be fired or not hired at all or not promoted on the job. And all of us either had been discriminated against or knew friends or family who were. And that means that people who were evicted from their apartments, were denied a mortgage, were fired or not promoted and so on, or had been denied service at a restaurant. So we gathered together a group of people from our community leaders and organizations and talked about the ordinance. We drafted the ordinance with the Legislative Bureau in Harrisburg, and it was state-of-the-art in Pennsylvania. Being the second city, we researched all over the country for similar state and local ordinances to make sure that the law included being perceived as gay. You didn't
even if you weren't,
right.
Just being perceived.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And or as transgender. And this was really, as I said, state of the art, because Philadelphia did not even have that protection. So we worked with City Council. It was truly a bipartisan effort. Many organizations, including the National Organization for Women, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, the Pennsylvania Lesbian Gay Support Network, Dignity, labor organizations, parents and friends of labor of lesbians and gays. So many groups who came together to work with city council. In the end, after the all was said and done, it passed unanimously, which was unheard of in that era.
When was it? What year was that?
1983.
Okay,
June of 83. Mm-hmm. And that meant that the Harrisburg Human Relations Commission could take and investigate complaints of discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodations. And that still exists today within the city limits of Harrisburg. Unfortunately, it doesn't cover Pennsylvania state government county government, but private and public employers within the city limits of Harrisburg. So if you go out to Camp Hill, for example, where Dan Miller was fired as a CPA.
Dan Miller is the city treasurer.
Correct.
Who had to run for mayor.
Correct. In the 80s, he spoke out against discrimination in the state and was promptly fired. But he could not have the ability to file a complaint because it occurred outside the city limits of Harrisburg. So there was a lot going on to get the bill passed. It was certainly not passed without controversy or struggle, and there was some opposition. But mostly it was an outpouring of support, and hundreds of people came to city council meetings and to speak about the bill. At that time, of course, it was very courageous to do so because you could be fired the next day. And the president of the local chapter of Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays had her apartment set on fire at the entrance when she spoke out for the bill. Fortunately, no one was hurt or significant damage.
What you're describing, you said Harrisburg was the second city in Pennsylvania, which may surprise a lot of people because central Pennsylvania has a reputation of being conservative. Now, we're talking about the city of Harrisburg and not just the suburbs. But this is the way that it has gone even since 1983 across the state is if there has been anti-discrimination legislation, it has been passed on the local level, not on the state level. We'll talk about the state in just a moment. But how many cities, municipalities, townships now have anti-discrimination laws that include LGBTQ?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 54 municipalities around the state, including a couple of counties, Erie and Allegheny County, have protections. But that's out of 2,560 total municipalities in Pennsylvania. So more than 2,500 do not have any protections.
And what you're describing, Mary, you said that if there is found to be a violation that, or at least suspect to be a violation, that it can be investigated. This is not a criminal matter, correct?
That's correct. It's a civil law.
So what happens if someone is found to have been discriminated against, fired, or evicted because of their sexual orientation or identification?
Well, there are remedies that are called make-whole remedies, and that means that you can be reinstated or you can be paid back pay for if you were fired, or you can be given the next apartment, or you have legal redress. It's not pain and suffering or any additional monies other than what you lost, but is to make you whole for what you suffered.
If there is physical violence, obviously that is against the law. That is a crime no matter how you identify your ethnic, racial, sexual orientation. But there are some places, though, where it is a hate crime. What about here in Pennsylvania?
We do not have currently hate crime protections that would enhance penalties if the crime was proven to be because of one's sexual orientation or gender identity or expression. Mm. We did have it for a short time, but it was ruled to be not passed as germane to that bill.
And that was only recently, recent years. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a very short time that it was in effect, right?
Right. But the state legislature, there has been another bill introduced to make a hate crime again part of our legal.
So Barry, what your really what your goal is, and part of the exhibit, is not just to present history, but is to campaign for just what you're talking about, that there be a statewide law, anti-discrimination law. First of all, it may surprise some people. I know it surprises people that it doesn't exist now in this day and age, but it doesn't. Are we any closer to getting that here in Pennsylvania?
Well, we're hopeful this year that it might be a possibility of getting passed. You know, Pennsylvania is the last state in the Northeast not to have this kind of legislation on the books. And we think that, you know, the climate may be a little bit different now, that people would start realizing that this is an important part of our protecting our community and welcoming people into our communities. You know, the exhibit really is a way to raise awareness of that issue and also to let people know that it's been a long, long history in trying to work towards these protections. And the exhibit's traveling all over the state.
There are three
copies,
right,
of the exhibit, and we actually have about 25 bookings already of the exhibit all over Pennsylvania, including college campuses and libraries and elderly senior housing facilities. So it's a wonderful kind of mix of places where people can go and see the exhibit now.
Where is it locally and in over the next few weeks or so?
Yeah, it just finished up at Thaddeus Stevens College.
In Lancaster,
right. Mm-hmm. And also had been up to Juniata College recently. Now it's still at the Harrisburg State Capitol where we premiered it last week, and it's up through Friday of this week. Another copy is going over to Dickinson College starting tomorrow for a week in Carlisle. And a number of places in central PA as well as other locations around the state.
What do you want people to take away from that? And I'm not just talking about LGBTQ people. I'm talking about everyone. When I say people, I mean everyone.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and everyone probably knows someone who was LGBTQ in their life, whether it's a relative or a friend.
Probably?
Yeah, most likely.
I'd say 100% sure of that.
It's quite likely. So, so think about the fact that you'd want these kind of protections for the people that you care about. And, you know, it's really an opportunity to reach out to them and, you know, express that, you know, concern and that interest in helping them by supporting this kind of legislation and letting your legislators know that you do and letting your municipal officials know that they're appreciated for having passed it in the places that have it and that they need to pass it in the places that don't.
Why hasn't it happened up until now?
Well, it's just been a difficult struggle with politics. And, you know, our legislators have taken a very conservative view on this issue for many, many years. And we just really haven't had the majority willing to, you know, provide those protections.
I think that we will see a good many sponsors to the legislation that has been reintroduced in the Senate and in the House this year. Every legislative session, beginning, of course, in January this year, has to reintroduce,
right,
the bill.
Yep.
And what you'll see is many people on both sides of the aisle. And
so this is a bipartisan effort.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it is a simple statement that everyone should have the equal right to be free of discrimination. Mm-hmm. Now, the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission can take your complaint if you have been discriminated against, but that is merely policy to try to investigate it under sex discrimination. But policy is not the same as having the force of law. Mm-hmm. And policies can be changed by incoming governors or new sets of commissioners and so forth. So it's paramount that we have the ability to have this codified in law and make sure that all Pennsylvanians have an equal right to employment, housing, and public accommodations.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Barry Loveland is the chair of the LGBT History Project. Mary Nancaro is an LGBT community activist. She helped to pass the Harrisburg Non-Discrimination Ordinance, and historic in nature, as Mary mentioned, 1983, second city in the state. Thank you very much for being with us, and encourage everyone to go see the exhibit.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accidents. So be sure to tune in.